thank you very much, Terry. And David's done a great job of setting us up here in terms of use of hydrocarbons in the developing world. And so what we're going to take a look is we're going to look at one of the contemporary ways that hydrocarbons are being used in the world. And sort of the catchy title I have here is Would God Frack? But obviously I don't know the answer to that question. But I'm going to give you a little bit of backdrop in terms of why I even wondered about that. And that was about a year ago. I was viewing on YouTube a video about the ethics of fracking. And somebody appeared in that video whom I've worked with in the past, somebody who I have a lot of respect for, and that's Holy Cross brother David Andrews. He's a senior representative of Earth and Water Watch. And what he said in that video was that his God, being a God of justice, truth, honesty, and integrity, would not frack. And that really struck me because I have such great respect for Brother Andrews. And it really made me stop and think, because I, a year ago, was very supportive of fracking. And I said, am I missing something here? And his reasoning for saying that God wouldn't do this is because Brother Andrews suggests that fracking is bad for communities, animals, and the environment, and can spew toxicity everywhere. So this kind of launched me on a bit of examination of to what extent is this true, what Brother Andrews is saying. And so what I'm going to do is just sort of share what where I am right now in terms of this. But first we want to just very quickly define some of the terms. And hydraulic fracturing, many of you know what this is. It's essentially just using high-pressure water to break rock and to allow oil or gas to escape out of the cracks and come to the surface. Here's the standard picture that everybody uses to show hydraulic fracturing. There's two things I want to point your attention to on this slide. One is you can actually see the fractures that people are talking about, okay? And you need to fracture the rock because it's impermeable and gas and oil will not flow out of it, and that's what fracturing does. But the second point is, and this is where a lot of the controversy is that when you bore down to these hydrocarbon layers, you have to go through groundwater, you go through well water. And you'll notice that's what this blue is. And so anywhere from 500 to 1,000 feet, you are going through regions of rock which have well water, which can become contaminated. And you'll notice on this slide that the way this is done is that there are multiple layers. This is representing multiple layers of steel and concrete that prevents the hydraulic fracturing process from polluting the groundwater. And this is one of the big fears of this technology. Actually, I lied a little bit when I said hydraulic fracturing was that picture. Actually, this picture over here is also hydraulic fracturing. The fact of the matter is we've been doing hydrofracking for over 60 years on a commercial scale. All right, and that's what this picture is showing, that since the 1960s, we've been using fracturing technology to drill down to shallow geological deposits, and if they're impermeable, we frack them in order to allow the oil and gas to flow up and out so that we can retrieve it. What is new is the fact that today we're able to drill extremely deeply and we're able to drill horizontally. This is what all the controversy is. The horizontal drilling, we've only been able to do it for about 10 years, okay? And the fact that we can do that and fracture it means that we can drill very, very deep. And to drill deep is expensive. To be able to afford the drilling, you have to get a large volume of hydrocarbon out to pay for it. And the fact that we can drill horizontally, we can now, through fracturing, expose a large surface area of the rock to the well bore and get a lot of hydrocarbon out. And so that's actually the new technology, is the horizontal drilling. And the danger is the scale of horizontal, it's referred to as unconventional drilling. the scale is extremely large. There's lots of hydrocarbon that comes out, and there's lots of water that needs to be put into it in order to fill up this hole. This can easily be a mile down and a mile horizontally. And so it's just the scale is the thing that's new. All right, so we know what fracking is. We know what unconventional gas and oil development is. Okay, I want to change gears a little bit, and I want to get into the development mode. And so what I'm going to do is I'm going to, as I develop this talk more, I'm going to ultimately end up and take a look at how fracking can impact a region of the world in terms of development. And I'm going to pick South Africa. And the reason why I pick South Africa is that in the HDI curves and energy consumption that David put up in the last talk, South Africa is somewhere in the middle of the pack. And so we can sort of use South Africa to give us a sense about development issues right now in a country that's about in the middle of the pack. And first of all, can South Africa, does it have shale gas? And in fact, it does. Here's South Africa. And we can see one of the things that people don't, shale gas is everywhere. It's in Australia, it's in China, it's in UK. And of course, all we hear about, though, is what's going on in the United States, because this is where all the development is happening right now. But it's really a global commodity. And South Africa actually has world-class scale, potentially world-class scale amounts of shale gas, about two-thirds of what the United States have. You see, the bulk of it is in China. And actually, as we speak, they're drilling wells in South Africa in the Karoo Basin, and Shell is the company that's doing it, and by the end of 2015, they will know whether there is a possibility of commercially developing shale gas in South Africa. Okay, in that context, let's take a look at sort of the bigger picture in terms of shale gas development. But I'm going to look at the need for shale gas. I'm going to look at health, safety, and environmental issues, carbon emissions issues, and costs. Starting with the need, I'm going to use World Bank estimates. Roughly 20% of the population does not have electricity. Okay, it's about over a billion people. Additionally, and this is a huge factor that is going to be talked about in the next talk, even people who have electricity, they don't have it in a sufficient amount to do things like cooking. And it turns out that roughly 3 billion people cook and heat their houses with coal, wood, dung, things such as this. And this generates a huge problem in terms of indoor air pollution. And anywhere from 1.5 million to several million people allegedly die per year because of emphysema, respiratory issues. A little bit more finer detail on South Africa, about 50 million people. Average household income for the white population, which is about 10% of the population, is 42,000. Average black income is around 8,000. There's about 9,000 households in South Africa, and about 2 million of these households are shacks. From 94, when the Republic was founded, up until 2011, they built about 1.5 million nicer homes to replace some of these shacks, but the poverty in South Africa is growing faster than their capacity to get people out of poverty, so this is a big issue. Only about 57% of the households in South Africa have flush toilets, and only about 85% have electricity. Here's one of the prettiest places in Africa, Cape Town. The metropolitan part of Cape Town is right here. This is a Table Mountain. This peak is Devil's Peak. I was fortunate enough to go on sabbatical in spring 2012 to the University of Cape Town, which is located right over here at the base of Devil's Peak. And so I did spend some time in Cape Town and was able to experience it and get a firsthand view of development issues in this part of South Africa. Here's the University of Cape Town, lovely place underneath Devil's Peak. And Cape Town is a gorgeous place, But it's a community that has two different types of communities. This is the affluent part of Cape Town. It's absolutely gorgeous. Mountains, seas, palm trees, spectacular. This is the other part of Cape Town. This is called Cape Town Flats. This is what the shacks that I was referring to look like. In Cape Town, there's about 85,000 of these shacks containing about 400,000 people. Many of these shacks do not even have electricity. This is what a shack or a shanty looks like. It's about the size of my garage, and on average, you're going to have about 5 people living in this shack. These are what the new houses that they're replacing the shacks with. The cost of the South African government about $11,000 to build these shacks. And as I told you, there's a problem with being able to develop this housing for these people. And over the last year or so, they've had about 100 demonstrations in South Africa, allegedly about the slow pace of development for poor people. Okay, so that's the need. Clearly there's need around the world. Clearly there's need for development in South Africa. Health, safety. I'm going to look at three simple studies with respect to health. First one is a study published in The Lancet, 2007, using 2005 data. Okay, and really what this was looking at hydrocarbon electricity generation, coal versus gas. What are the health implications of that? Natural gas, much better than coal. Much better than coal. In terms of the amount of death that can be attributed to coal-fired power plants, it's about 25 deaths per terawatt hour. Gas is way less, about 3,000 deaths per terawatt hour. Okay. Now, if we were to crunch these numbers and put it in scale in terms of how many terawatt hours does the world use, roughly you're talking about, in terms of coal-fired power plants globally, in terms of the amount of energy we produce, we're talking about 500,000 people per year are killed through the use of coal-fired power plants. That's going to be black lung, that's going to be cave-ins, accidents, and people who get with the coal effluent, respiratory emphysema, and all of that. So it's a very large number. But we need to compare that number with the number that die in terms of internal cooking with coal or wood. It was millions of people die per year. So just sort of to balance those. Okay, different study. This is done by the UK Royal Society of Engineering, peer-reviewed report, looking at can we develop shale gas in the UK? And they looked at all aspects, and I'm just going to look at the summary here. Health, safety, environmental risks associated with fracking as a means of extracting shale gas can be managed effectively in the UK as long as operational best practices are implemented, and that's very important. Operational best practices need to be implemented, and they change yearly. What the best practices are, with experience, we learn what they are and we adapt. And they have to be enforced through regulation. And as I mentioned previously, hydraulic fracturing is an established technology that's been used in the oil and gas industry for decades. Final report. I live in Pennsylvania, and in the United States, Pennsylvania is where the bulk of the expansion of fracking has been happening. And there was a very recent report which looked at how much water damage is happening in Pennsylvania, and the way this topic was developed. They looked at the state agency that is responsible for regulating environmental issues in Pennsylvania, and they looked over the range from 2008 to 2012. There were greater than 6,000 wells drilled in Pennsylvania, and greater than 4,000 of these were fracked. And the question is, how much water damage how many problems did they have? And what they said is they had approximately 20 unconventional wells, unambiguously contaminated water, and they had about 30 large spills. Most of the water contamination incidents involved faulty well casings. And so I told you earlier that picture that the well casing is extremely important. And when they have problems with water, that's usually the place that it happens. It turns out that's about a quarter of a percent of the wells that they fracked and drilled. And the main problem is methane leaks. Methane leaks and it gets into people's wells. The most famous case of this, I'm sure you've all heard about, was Dimmock, Pennsylvania, where they had a faulty well casing which put methane in the water wells of about 18 homes. Next, we'll look at carbon emissions. Carbon emissions, if we take a look from 2005 to 2013, everybody knows the U.S. uses a lot more hydrocarbons than anybody else. Europe uses about half the amount that we do. And so let's just take a look at how the world is doing in terms of addressing carbon emissions. So during this time frame, we know that Europe spent a lot of time and money and energy in terms of going green, and they've decreased their carbon footprint about 14%, Germany about 3.5%. Interesting case in point is the United States decreased its carbon footprint. Admittedly, it's big, but it's decreased it by 10% with very little focus on trying to do it green. And they did this totally for economic reasons. It switched out coal for gas, and it had a big impact on the carbon emissions. And the United States did this for economic reasons only. But we have to recognize, in terms of the developed world, as David pointed out, needs energy. And the energy has to be cheap. Expensive energy does nobody any good. It has to be cheap. And so let's take a look. We said that shale gas in the U.S. is cheap. And here's the most recent data we have. The red line is U.S. price for 1,000 cubic feet, or million, 1,000 cubic feet of gas. It's about $4 for 1,000 cubic feet. The European price right now, or a year ago, somewhere around $13. Price in Japan is somewhere around $16. And so the price of the fuel is very important. That price of that fuel is going to be one of the components in determining the price of electricity. And if we just take a quick look at our 2011 average electricity prices per kilowatt hour. Europe's got the highest electricity in the world. UK, India in the middle. United States and Canada are towards the bottom. Okay. And once again, looking at cost of electricity generation, comparing the different ways that we can generate electricity per million, per 1,000 watt hours, coal is about $95. Gas, advanced combined cycle, is $64, so it's cheaper than coal. Wind is actually cheaper than coal, but if you factor in the tax credits that go on, it pushes the cost of wind above coal. And of course, solar is more expensive. Geothermal is actually a beautiful form of energy if you can find it. Fuel poverty, we have to look at that. And essentially, fuel poverty is a big issue. As you increase the price of energy, you drive a larger percentage of your population into fuel poverty, where they have to choose between heating their home in winter versus putting food on the table. UK is the place where they've done the most studies of this, and they found that in UK, from 2003 to 2011, they put 17% of their households in fuel poverty. This correlates to roughly around 24,000 additional deaths per year, and this presumably is older people who are cold in the winter, getting pneumonia and dying, things like that. Germany is the greenest place in the world. 20% of their energy is split between wind and solar. And let's just take a look at what's happening in Germany right now. Simultaneously with instituting green energy, they've decided to phase out nuclear. And this is causing a huge stress to their system. And essentially, you can't run your societal energy just on wind and sun, because the sun doesn't always shine, the wind doesn't always blow. You have to have a dispersible form of energy. And the Germans are replacing their nuclear fleet with coal because gas is too expensive in Europe. And the cheap gas, why is the gas cheap in the United States? It's because the development that's occurring. The red dots are the wells, unconventional wells in Pennsylvania. In 2008, there were around 200. 2009, there were about 700 wells. And in 2010, there were 1,368 wells. And so it's an extremely rapid growth of unconventional wells that generate a large amount of gas, which makes the gas cheap in the United States. Can unconventional shale gas development in South Africa promote development? Coming back to that question, it's needed. South Africa is much poorer than Europe. Per capita income, 11,000 versus 34. And that's going to be reflected in things such as health. Just look at infant mortality. Europe, 4 deaths per 1,000 births. South Africa, the number's 42. So relationship between wealth and income and health, education, social support, all of that. And it turns out that somebody has looked at what would happen if you could develop the gas in South Africa. What could, if you developed it properly, what would it do for South Africa? And what they came up with, that if you developed it between 2017 and 2050, definitely you would increase the amount of wealth in the country. It would increase the per capita income in the country about $1,200 per person. It would also generate around $90 billion over this time frame for healthcare, education, and infrastructure. Also in this scenario, they put a tax on the development of gas, and when it was a tax that ballooned out in later years, and they took the money from that tax and used it to develop green energy, wind and solar to impact the carbon emissions. What does it all mean? Unconventional gas development can be done safely with minimal health and environmental impact. U.S. experience has shown that unconventional drilling can decrease the prices. Shale gas deposits are global and can be used to address global development, particularly in South Africa. The gas is clean compared to coal in terms of soot, mercury, and sulfur. And for this reason, I'm going to hypothesize that, yes, God would frack. In turn, it would frack sustainably to fund what's called authentic human development. Thank you. Well, as I said, I live in Pennsylvania, and it's partially what you're saying is true. But actually, people in the United States at least do have recourse because there's a huge number of lawsuits. The whole Dimmick, Pennsylvania thing ended up in court, and all of those 19 people that had their wells impacted essentially got their house either bought or got their well cleaned up. So, you know, Pennsylvania's having issues because the laws that were put in place to allow this to happen, actually people went to court, and those laws have now been tossed out, and they're we're now in the process of reworking the whole framework for energy development in Pennsylvania. So actually, people do have recourse through the legal system, and they're not as powerless as you might think. The legal system, at least in the United States, anybody who knows if you get injured at work or something in terms of workman compensation, you know, there's lawyers that will take legal cases and really go after the money, and the oil companies have money, so they're going to spend a lot of time in court addressing all these issues with you personally. Yes?
I would be concerned what it's going to be like 50 years from now.
Well, I think that it's a legitimate concern, and people are looking at it. These wells undergo inspection yearly, and so this is something that needs to be monitored, and it's a concern. But they're designed, as far as I know right now, to be able to survive long term like this. And you know, at a certain point in time, all the gas is gone, because Terry, I think you mentioned, the gas has actually gone out of these wells like in 10 years or so, and they actually didn't plug them, and the gas is all gone. So the gas wells, unconventional, aren't going to be hanging around for a long period of time. They will be plugged, and they remediate the area.
So maybe one more question. So you posted some data about the carbon emissions in the U.S. increasing by 10%.
Yeah.
And I probably agree with you that I attribute that to switching over to natural gas. But there are a lot of people who attribute that solely to the economic decline that happens during that same period. And it happens to business as usual, and that it happens that our carbon emissions are
Well, that's
high, and that the greenhouse effect
it is indeed correct that economic slowing is going to impact the carbon budget, but they've actually studied that quite carefully in Pennsylvania, because in Pennsylvania, because of the cheap gas, they actually have, they looked at just the number of coal-fired power plants that they shut down, the number of gases that they fired up, and a significant amount of that 10% is due to just the switch out. So, thank you.